This is AMDA On The Go, your gateway to expert discussions, journal article reviews, and innovation in post-acute and long-term care. AMDA On The Go is a presentation of the Society for Post-Acute and Long-Term Care Medicine. Support for this podcast is brought to you by U.S. Post-Acute Care. This podcast is eligible for ABPLM pre-approved certified medical director credits. Details will be provided at the end of this podcast. And now here's our host for AMDA On The Go, Dr. Wayne Saltzman.
Welcome to this special edition of AMDA On The Go. This podcast will focus on issues around behavioral health in the midst of the COVID-19 pandemic. Sadness, frustration, anger, confusion. These are just a few of the emotions that I'm feeling today in the midst of this COVID-19 pandemic. So I can only imagine the spectrum and caliber of emotions that patients, long-term care residents, families, caregivers, and my colleagues, the Joe AMDAs in the trenches, are experiencing right now as well. What I do know is that during the relative mayhem that exists around a situation such as COVID-19, with the focus on the what, the when, and the who, the how, namely how the patients, families, and caregivers are being affected by everything that is going on around them, may not be so much a focus. So what do we need to think about as well? How do we approach or consider the behavioral, mental, emotional health of those to whom we are providing care or with whom we are working? Well, I can think of no one more appropriate to help us navigate through the circulating emotions and mental health issues generated and potentially exacerbated via this COVID-19 pandemic within the skilled nursing setting than Drs. Leah Watson and Richard Juman. And we are fortunate to have both of them here with us now. Dr. Watson is a geriatric psychiatrist, teacher, and cheerleader for safe prescribing in late life. She is a clinical associate professor of psychiatry and geriatrics with the University of Colorado. She developed her own consulting and training firm to extend the reach of geriatric psychiatry. Dr. Richard Juman is a psychologist and the National Director of Psychology Services for Team Health, a provider group for skilled nursing facilities across the country. Dr. Watson, welcome back, and Dr. Juman, welcome to AMDA On The Go.
Thank you, Wayne.
Glad to be here. Thank you.
Dr. Watson, I'll start with you. AMDA, the Society for Post-Acute and Long-Term Care, has recognized the potential emotional impact on our resident and patient populations, those most vulnerable to COVID-19. I can't think of a time in which post-acute and long-term care has been more in the forefront. Identified as a focus by CMS Administrator Seema Verma, largely in response to the very sad events witnessed in Kings County, Washington, the Society has produced a white paper, Strategies for Mitigating the Emotional Impact of COVID-19. Why do we need to take a pause and consider not just the physical impact of the coronavirus, but also the emotional impact of a pandemic? You know, it's easy to see the patient as the object at this time. How do we reframe or adjust the approach of the provider to appreciate or recognize the person in the midst of it all?
That's a great question, Wayne. And I think the first thing we have to do is acknowledge our own anxiety, because I think there's such a great amount of uncertainty right now with some relatively unclear leadership to date about where we really are with everything. And what we know is the fear cycle is contagious. And the more uncertainty there is, the more fear we have. And so we first just really need to take a deep breath and recognize that we are not immune to that ourselves, to recognize our own anxiety regarding all of the uncertainty, and to really try to stay focused on what needs to be done today. And I think because of the, you know, ever-moving guidance that we're receiving, it's very unclear, which really requires even steadier leadership. And I think as we enter our buildings and work with our colleagues, we really need to be in the moment in a human way more than we ever have. And really, my mantra for this has been, you know, in this together. And we are all in this, not as providers and patients or clients, but all of us together, including all of the staff and the patients and the families. And I think a key consideration for me that I've actually engaged with quite a bit all week, and I've been on the phone all morning, is just staying calm and being willing to admit when we don't know what's going on, and to have transparency, mm-hmm. and to really try to listen to the human experience of our patients and our staff on the ground. I think what I'm struck by as a psychiatrist is that we really have engaged in the contagion of fear, because the crisis to date for most of us is actually not that great yet.
Right.
I think it's definitely coming, and now is the time when we need to get ourselves together, because most people do not have outbreaks in their building yet, are not having to respond to difficult decisions regarding triage of care or whether families can visit. And I think we really need to tamp down that contagion to deal with our immediate issues as they present today while we're preparing for the ones tomorrow. And as you said, not thinking of patients as objects is really key. And the thing I find myself thinking about when I'm awake at night this week is what will happen when people get sick, and they certainly will, and people start to die, as they certainly will. How will we adjust our rules and protocols to allow people to be together at the end of life? That's something we need to be thinking about in each of our respective facilities. We actually need to be spending more time, not less, with our residents and patients. And I think we actually need more staff and not less during this time, despite trying to create social distancing, because of the urgent need for people to be connected and feel taken care of. And of course, the downstream of all of that is we need to be able to pay people to be at work, and we need to be able to support our lowest wage earners who are feeling the most vulnerable and unprotected. So it's really a whole of the whole system that we need to take and address. And really it starts with damping down our own fear cycle to not create that sort of contagion.
You know, Dr. Juman, I would kind of pose the question to you as well as, you know, the leader working with a provider group. What is the mantra along these lines that, you know, Team Health is kind of telling its folks who are truly in the trenches, you know, as a cohesive unit?
Yeah, I mean, I would first step back, Wayne, and, you know, put the current scenario with coronavirus into a larger context.
Please.
So, you know, in my mind, nursing facilities have to treat both the medical and the emotional needs of our residents. And that's actually, you know, a mandate from CMS that we provide the services needed to maximize the residents' whole emotional and mental well-being. So right now, in spite of that mandate, the, you know, majority of treatment and money and attention in post-acute goes towards the medical, as opposed to mental health issues, despite the fact that psychiatric illness is now really the norm in skilled nursing, as opposed to the exception. Mm. We've got, you know, tremendous amount of depression and now chronic mental illness, substance use disorders, but it's still a medical scenario, and the quality of medical care provided is significantly better than it's ever been in post-acute care, but I don't think that we've kept up on the behavioral health side.
Right.
So I think that, you know, our response to the coronavirus is following the same paradigm. You know, there's an intense focus on the medical aspects of it and containment, and not enough on the potential impact to the residents' psychological well-being. So just going in with that mindset that, yes, obviously job number one is to do everything that we can to mitigate the impact of the virus, but in doing so, we also need to make sure that we're doing everything that we can to mitigate the potential emotional impacts, which could be quite significant as well.
You know, Dr. Juman, I'll stay with you for a bit, but we talk about and train around the concept of trauma-informed care today in multiple healthcare circles. Remind us of what that is, why it deserves our ongoing attention and why we need to be sensitive to those with a history of trauma during the processes, interactions, and treatments for this thing that we call COVID-19.
Yeah, sure. So, you know, obviously, I think most listeners will be aware that in just the last few months, skilled nursing facilities are now mandated to provide trauma-informed care, quote unquote. And what that really means is that we need to be aware of the possibility that a significant number of our residents may have a history of trauma, may actually have PTSD or some other type of trauma-related disorder. And we need to go out of our way to identify those people, to minimize the triggers, and, you know, most importantly, to avoid re-traumatizing people. So SAMHSA talks, when they talk about the concept of trauma, they talk about the four R's. First one is realization, that we want to understand trauma and its impacts. Second R is to recognize the signs of trauma. Third is to respond to the presence or potential presence of trauma in terms of the language that we use, the behavior that we engage in, and our policies. And then finally, to resist re-traumatization. So now we have a scenario with COVID-19 where all kinds of new things are happening. Quarantines and isolations and perhaps new equipment and people walking around, you know, garbed in different ways. We have people potentially disconnected from their loved ones. And then this is all happening already, despite the fact, as Dr. Watson pointed out, you know, outside of a few isolated facilities, we're really not seeing the actual impact of coronavirus in most facilities. When that kicks in, when people do start to become ill and perhaps pass away, all of these things are going to be difficult for everybody, but certainly more difficult for people with a history of trauma where the experiences they've had in the past are being mirrored by what's happening now.
Right.
So going out of our way to identify residents who have a history of trauma so that we can be on guard against how they may react to what we're doing and they may react to what happens as the virus progresses is going to be extremely important.
Mm-hmm. And you mentioned SAMHSA, the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration, SAMHSA.gov, as having information regarding trauma-informed care as well.
Yes, absolutely.
So, Dr. Watson or Dr. Juman, in the same context, obviously in our special population, do considerations around the potential responses of older adults with dementia also need to be discerned at this time as well?
Yeah, they definitely do. And I'll just back up a second to say that really good trauma-informed care is the care we actually need to be providing to everyone right now. And that the tenets of that are very straightforward, but include safety, which is the first thing. So we need to really reassure people, and this includes all patients, including those with dementia, that they are safe and that we have transparency and trustworthiness. We also need to empower people to have their own voice and choice and really recognize the cultural context for each person as they traverse these uncertain times. And that is also on the SAMHSA website, sort of these six principles. But the good news is they really apply to everyone. And for dementia in particular, I think that the main thing I want to say from a medical perspective is that what we're really mostly trying to protect against is a delirium in folks with dementia.
Right.
There's going to be a lot of upset and unsettling in a lot of ways, but preventing delirium, which can set off a whole course of negative events, can be caused not just by medications and medical issues. It can be caused by change in routines. So the list we've put together of things that are really important include primarily trying to keep continuity in staffing as much as possible, limiting unnecessary interruptions such as routine labs or x-rays, decreasing the frequency or need for vital signs or checking blood sugar if at all possible. Do the things that we already know help, facilitate exercise, get people into the sunlight if they can. If people have favorite foods or activities, and we usually are somewhat restrictive with those, let them enjoy them more liberally. And I'll just say, as a medication safety advocate, we will definitely be called by our very stressed out staff asking if we can give Mrs. Jones a little something because she seems agitated on a much more frequent basis than we have historically. And I think we really have to resist the temptation to medicate that anxiety, which can, of course, hasten the delirium. Other things that can be super helpful that I've seen work well is to really consider roommate assignments for compatibility, put people together that actually inspire more calm roommate interaction. Just simple things, but I saw it this week, a person that had to gown up for another potential infection risk, and the patient really unraveled. And once the provider took off their gown and mask and talked to them from the door to distance, they calmed down. So something as simple as not overdoing the gowning and masking unless you absolutely have to can make a huge difference for someone living with dementia.
The success of your practice depends on a support team that knows exactly how to navigate through the many variables and nuances of post-acute medicine. Based on years of practical clinical experience, the team at U.S. Post Acute Care is dedicated to enabling you to deliver the very best quality of patient care, providing a unique complement of administrative and clinical educational support services. To learn more about what U.S. Post Acute Care can do for your practice, visit uspostacutecare.com.
We're talking with Drs. Leah Watson and Richard Juman about the emotional impact that can occur within the skilled nursing setting by COVID-19. Question is to both of you. Please lead us through some of the key strategies that are discussed in the white paper regarding families, maintaining activities, and around escalating behavioral health issues. You know, how do those of us who trained to control a situation do so when the situation is changing in caliber, all the time?
You know, I would, first echo what Dr. Watson said about maintaining as much consistency as possible, especially for residents with dementia. It can't be overstated that change is difficult for people with dementia. Mm. So going to the hospital or having a new roommate or, having a new nurse's aide, these are all potentially cataclysmic sea changes for somebody with dementia. So all of the hullabaloo that's going to be going on around preparing for COVID-19 is going to produce a lot of change. So anything that we can do to make the environment as consistent as possible is really going to be helpful. Mm-hmm. So, one of the things that is really important is to for facilities to have a clear message for residents and families about what's happening around the virus and give talking points to the staff. So, we don't want staff members unilaterally, messaging to residents and families. We want a clear, consistent message that's been agreed upon by the facility administration. The message obviously, puts forth the point that any procedures that are being put in place are based on the best science available, and we want to be as reassuring as we can be. Obviously, family visits are now, going to be very different, but that doesn't mean that they should stop happening. So in the last, decade, the potential to use alternative technologies for family visits like Skype or FaceTime have really increased dramatically. So helping residents, keep their connections to families you know, alive, you know, during this period is going to be really important. And social services and therapeutic recreation hopefully can take a lead in that, since other staff members might be involved in more clinical duties. We want facilities to maintain their activities insofar as is possible, keeping to a normal routine. Obviously, some of those activities might need to be changed a bit due to infection control procedures, and hopefully therapeutic recreation around the country can think creatively about how to keep residents engaged in activities and, you know, fill up some of that empty time. Clearly, there's going to be a spike in behavioral health issues, anxieties in particular, around the coronavirus. So we want to make sure that facilities are asking residents how they're doing on the behavioral side of things, screening for anxiety or spikes in depression, making sure that they get help that they need if they're reporting an increase in mental health issues, et cetera. And then obviously, we want to do whatever we can to support our staff members who are going to be going through a difficult time in addition to the residents.
That was great, Richard. I think the only thing I would add to that regarding psychiatric issues is that, you know, we have an increasing prevalence of people living with chronic mental illness in our settings. And clearly, a virus like this sets off a lot of triggers for people with paranoia or chronic psychotic illnesses. So looking out for people that do have delusions and hallucinations to be getting worse, and having an emergency plan in place. So I know that there is really a dearth of psychiatric and psychology resources in a lot of homes, but almost everybody has a plan about crisis management. And now is the time to really be looking at what your plan is if suddenly a patient refuses to take their antipsychotic because they're afraid the virus is in it, for instance, and how you're going to think about whether it's worth it to put that patient on a hold and send them to the hospital. What are the trade-offs with regard to safety and infection control? Those are things that really need to be sorted through right now so that you have a plan and are proactive if or when that sort of thing happens.
So typically, with AMDA on the go, the last question is a bit of a provocative one, but that's not going to be the case here. But I'm very interested in your responses to this question, as I think it's very important with regard to our colleagues, which actually Dr. Juman intimated to a bit ago. In a recent interview, former White House physician and current congressional candidate, Dr. Ronnie Jackson, commented that we will look back on this situation and see that we overreacted a little bit. You know, the words that leaders use during a crisis can be inspirational or they can be potentially harmful to folks such as our colleagues in the trenches of care. And we physicians are naturally seen as leaders. The white paper talks about controlling the message, and Dr. Juman mentioned it briefly before. While we are obviously mainly thinking about the patients and residents, how do we think about the wellness of our colleagues as well? How do we relate to each other? Each of us having been trained to be, as I like to think about it, ducks on the pond. We're calm on the surface, but underneath the water, we're working furiously to take care of business. How can we maintain our own mental, spiritual, emotional health during the COVID-19 pandemic and the challenges yet to come? And how can we find inspiration during challenging times? A bunch of questions, but I think they're so important.
Well, for me, the question reminds me of the question about, you know, what it would take for the world to come together. You know, how do we achieve world peace? And, you know, you'll often hear the flip answer that, well, we would have to be invaded by aliens in order for all of the world to come together and unite. So that's kind of a macro example. And what we have with COVID-19 in skilled nursing facilities on a more micro level, you know, is certainly a scenario where we all need to work together. skilled nursing staff, day in, day out, are really unsung heroes. They care for the population of this country that nobody else can and nobody else wants to. And they do it with very little celebration and not a great amount of financial remuneration. And now, on top of all that, we have an extraordinary, new, unprecedented scenario. So it's really going to take everybody involved in skilled nursing, from associations to large owner-operator groups to large physician groups and everyone who practices in skilled nursing, to band together and really rise to the occasion and recognize that the people on the front lines, particularly the CNAs, are going to be doing most of the heavy lifting.
Right.
So I think it's time for everybody to do whatever we can to pitch in to help that group. They're going to be perhaps dealing with staff shortages. They're already at risk for burnout and exhaustion. So anything that we can do as providers, anything that facilities can do, owners and administrators, to care for the line workers, care for the unsung heroes, is really, this is the moment where we need to pull out all the stops in terms of trying to find ways to reward them, trying to find ways to support them, trying to find ways to improve their work-life balance. One of the things that we'll do at Team Health is we'll come in and we'll do stress management training for the clinical staff in skilled nursing facilities to give them another tool that they can use to rise above what is likely to be an extraordinarily difficult journey. So, you know, we're committed to doing everything possible, and it's going to take everybody in skilled nursing to make that same commitment in order for everybody to get through this okay.
Yeah, and I'll just add a couple of things. And I think that we really do need to learn how to take care of ourselves and keep to our own routine and our own practices of daily life that keep us grounded, exercise, meditation, sleep, taking breaks, really doing one thing at a time and not getting overwhelmed. I'd actually been on the phone with 8 or 10 people just this morning that are peers that are trying to figure out how to prioritize their work week because they're so overwhelmed. And so we really do need to just do one thing at a time. The other practices that I've seen really be successful at a few facilities, I'll just share. And I think that it has to do with the sort of the inoculation we all feel by being together in fellowship. Some people see this in their faith communities. But in work settings, even a small huddle before and after a shift where we all come together with our social distance appropriate, but just have a time of sharing. Share what was the good thing of the day, what was the harder things of the day. Find the joy in the small moments. You know, there are interesting silver linings. I don't know if anyone saw the Italians all singing from their balconies.
Right.
This weekend.
Yes.
You know, we could open the doors to our rooms if we're not in a negative pressure room, and we could have someone play the guitar in the common room and have everyone stand at their door and have a huge sing-along. There's so many things that we can do, I think, and it's in times of stress where people actually are more open and more vulnerable to feeling that joy and connection, and I think that's the silver lining in all of this. But we can't do it if we don't take care of our own needs. So some things are going to get left undone. We're not going to be able to be the super parent and the super community member and be at the nursing home every single day, all day long, and do everything that we're being asked to do. So we're going to have to prioritize. And I really feel strongly that we need to get ourselves together because this is just beginning. Mm-hmm. So we need to have some tried and true strategies about how we care for ourselves and for each other. And that's going to be creative and unique to each home and setting and culture where you work, but I've already seen it in play here, and it's a beautiful thing to see.
Never has the phrase, we are all on the same team, meant so much. Mm-hmm. We have been privileged to speak with and learn from valued society resources on behavioral health issues, Drs. Leah Watson and Richard Juman. Dr. Watson and Dr. Juman, thank you so much for spending your time with AMDA On The Go.
Thank you, Wayne.
My pleasure. Thank you.
References for this podcast and for COVID-19 in general can be found at the Society website, paltc.org. Until next time, I'm Dr. Wayne Saltzman for this special edition of the innovation podcast that we call AMDA On The Go.
Support for this podcast is brought to you by U.S. Post-Acute Care. If you are a physician and interested in obtaining ABPLM pre-approved certified medical director credits for certification or recertification, go to our new learning management system at apex.paltc.org. Click on podcast and follow the link to this latest episode. Thank you.